Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, September 19th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. New York and other states form health bloc as answer to Trump's policies. Northeastern governors, like their peers in the West, want to shore up public health and issue a stamp of approval for vaccines. By Joseph Goldstein. New York and several other northeastern states are forging a regional public health coalition to issue vaccine recommendations and coordinate public health efforts in a rebuke of the Trump administration's shifts on health policy. Governor Kathy Hochul announced New York's involvement in the initiative on Thursday morning. "By standing with our partners across the Northeast, we are ensuring that New Yorkers have the protection and the information they need to stay safe and healthy," she said in a statement. The effort is similar to the West Coast Health Alliance, a bloc of four Democratic-controlled Western states, including California, that issued its own vaccine guidance this week. Both the Western and Northeastern regional coalitions reflect efforts to shore up public health efforts and give a government stamp of approval to vaccines at a time when federal public health institutions are in retreat. Like the Western initiative, this one, known as the Northeast Public Health Collaborative, is particularly focused on encouraging widespread vaccination as the federal health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., wages a broad campaign against vaccines. In recent weeks, the federal government has canceled major contracts for vaccine research and development and imposed restrictions that limit access to updated versions of the coronavirus vaccine. Ms. Hochul on Thursday said the group of states had jointly decided to issue recommendations for who should receive the most recent coronavirus vaccines: infants and toddlers between 6 and 23 months old and adults older than 19. The recommendations state that healthy children older than 2 years and adolescents may be vaccinated against the coronavirus, and that any children with underlying health conditions should be vaccinated. As Washington continues to launch its misguided attacks on science, New York is making it clear that every resident will have access to the COVID vaccine and the health care they rely on, Ms. Hochul said. The announcement about the creation of the coalition came on the same day that a federal panel that recommends vaccine policies, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, widely known as ACIP, was meeting to review immunizations that have long been part of efforts to curtail infectious diseases. Mr. Kennedy has frequently questioned the safety of those vaccines. Asked about the coalition, a spokesman for the Federal Department of Health and Human Services said that states run by Democrats embrace failed public health policies during the early days of the coronavirus pandemic and suggested they were in no position to lead on public health. Democrat-run states that pushed unscientific school lockdowns, toddler mask mandates, and draconian vaccine passports during the COVID era completely eroded the American people's trust in public health agencies, the spokesman Andrew Nixon said. ACIP remains the scientific body guiding immunization recommendations in this country, and HHS will ensure policy is based on rigorous evidence and gold standard science, not the failed policies of the pandemic. The recommendations by the Coalition of States for the updated coronavirus vaccines differ sharply from those issued by the federal government. Last month, the Food and Drug Administration authorized the updated coronavirus vaccines only for people 65 and older, and for younger people who have underlying medical conditions that make COVID more dangerous. But it did not authorize the vaccines for healthy adults younger than 65. That led a number of state officials, including Ms. Hochul, to issue executive orders intended to circumvent the federal restrictions by authorizing pharmacists to give the latest coronavirus vaccines to most people who want them. The Northeast Public Health Collaborative includes New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maine, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maryland, and New York City, which has the largest municipal health department in the nation. State health officials touted the values of neighborliness and self-reliance in explaining the need for the coalition. The people of Maine are known for their resilience, neighborly support, and a collaborative approach to solving community challenges, Dr. Putiri Va, the director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said. This spirit is evident in the Northeast Public Health Collaborative, which serves as an incubator for solutions in public health. Planning for the collaborative had been underway for some time, and representatives from state health departments met at a hotel in Rhode Island last month to hammer out specifics, officials said. The initiative has already formed working groups on topics including vaccine recommendations, data collection, and laboratory capacity. In interviews, public health officials said the working groups considered the significant layoffs at the federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other federal health agencies in identifying areas for collaboration among local public health officials. The working assumption is that local public health departments will have to find ways to fill in the gaps, as the federal government provides far fewer dollars and less guidance and assistance to health departments than before, the official said. We must always protect our public health infrastructure, reject misinformation, and maintain trust in science, the acting health commissioner of New York City, Dr. Michelle Morse, said. The collaborative is working together to rebuild public trust and provide factual information so people can make informed decisions about their health and continue our critical work to address health inequities. Officials said the effort built on existing cooperative efforts among the states, such as a long-standing network of New England public health laboratories whose directors have been meeting for decades to troubleshoot problems. Officials said that the members of the Northeast Public Health Collaborative intended to coordinate public health preparations for the 2026 World Cup and work together on state laboratory services. There have been preliminary discussions about jointly purchasing vaccines, officials said. During the past year, New York State's Health Department has been issuing a weekly report summarizing disease outbreaks across the world. The modest initiative comes as disease surveillance efforts at the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are in decline. Trump administration wields its full toolbox to bring media to heel. ABC's decision to indefinitely suspend Jimmy Kimmel's late-night talk show illuminates the administration's efficacy so far. By Jim Rutenberg. President Trump received thunderous applause during his second inaugural address in January when he vowed to immediately stop all government censorship and bring back free speech to America. It was in keeping with the popular free speech refrain of his long march out of the political wilderness and his first-term broadsides against cancel culture, which he had called the very definition of totalitarianism. His message had particular resonance with his supporters. After all, major social media companies banished him and others from their services in the days and weeks after the January 6, 2021 riots. Yet he is now conducting the most punishing government crackdown against major American media institutions in modern times, using what seems like every tool at his disposal to eradicate reporting and commentary with which he disagrees. ABC's decision on Wednesday to indefinitely suspend Jimmy Kimmel's late-night talk show for comments the host made about the assassination of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk illuminates the administration's efficacy so far. Far from decrying the silencing of a comedian, Mr. Trump celebrated what he termed a cancellation by declaring it great news for America on Truth Social. He later said networks whose hosts are critical of him should lose their right to broadcast. The decision comes after multimillion-dollar legal settlements from CBS and ABC in lawsuits filed by Mr. Trump that legal experts had viewed as long shots. After CBS News's agreement to change the way it presents political interviews under administration pressure, and after an agreement by CBS's newly merged parent company, Paramount Skydance, to appoint an ombudsman to hear complaints about its coverage, the company named for the job a conservative policy veteran. Taken together, the attacks on all our media institutions is certainly unprecedented in American history, said Victor Picard, a professor of media policy at the University of Pennsylvania. I can't think of any parallel. The Kimmel suspension was particularly striking, Professor Picard said. because it came so quickly after the Federal Communications Commission's chairman, Brendan Carr, a Trump appointee, suggested in unambiguous terms that he could consider punishing the local stations that carried Mr. Kimmel's shows. Mr. Carr was among those who had accused Mr. Kimmel of lying about the political beliefs of Mr. Kirk's assassin, Tyler Robinson. Mr. Kimmel, on his show on Monday, said that Mr. Trump's supporters were desperately trying to paint Mr. Robinson as anything other than one of them. Law enforcement authorities said Mr. Robinson of Utah had recently appeared to shift leftward in his views. Speaking with the right-wing podcaster Benny Johnson, Mr. Carr said the FCC was going to need to look into remedies, pointedly saying that the licensed broadcasters who carry ABC's programming needed to push back against the parent network. In putting the onus on ABC's stations, Mr. Carr appeared to be borrowing a page from the playbook of the Nixon administration. It had pioneered the practice of floating potential action against station licenses to pressure the major networks to toe the administration's line. The networks rely on independent stations and station groups to carry their programs nationally. Mr. Nixon saw the managers of those stations, particularly in Republican-led areas, as potential allies against their affiliated networks in New York. He was consumed by the Watergate scandal before the plan bore much fruit, but he was on to something. Some 30 years later, it was pressure from affiliates that helped force the last major cancellation of a late-night show in the wake of a political uproar. In 2002, ABC ended Bill Maher's show, Politically Incorrect, after criticism from the White House of comments he had made related to the September 11th attacks. The difference this time was that Mr. Carr's comments explicitly referred to the fact that stations are licensed by the government, and they were swiftly followed by announcements by a major station group with ABC affiliates, Nexstar, that it would independently preempt Mr. Kimmel's show. ABC followed with an announcement that it would do so nationally indefinitely, though it did not say why. As it happens, Nexstar is pursuing a station merger that will require FCC approval. Sinclair, another major owner of local stations, then said it would preempt Mr. Kimmel's show as well. Speaking on Sean Hannity's Fox News show after the cancellation, Mr. Carr sharpened his focus on station licenses, noting that broadcast license holders are expected to operate in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Conservative orthodoxy had long disfavored such government content dictates, which helped bring an end to the related fairness doctrine, which, among other things, required broadcasters to present all sides of disputed issues, in the Reagan era, and succeeded in bringing a more laissez-faire sensibility to the FCC. Mr. Carr noted that his agency had walked away from enforcing that public interest obligation, but told Mr. Hannity that was now changing. "We at the FCC are going to enforce the public interest obligation," he said. "If there's broadcasters out there that don't like it, they can turn their license in." Mr. Carr had been an ardent critic of the Biden administration when it sought to pressure social media platforms over the circulation of health and election misinformation. "We have been living through a surge in censorship," he said in a speech in the spring of 2024. "Anytime you have an increase in government control, you necessarily have a decrease in free speech, because free speech is the counterweight. Free speech is the check on government control." Then again, Mr. Trump made the same shift. Even now, he and his administration inveigh against any hint of so-called content moderation on social media, which tended to, for instance, affect him and his supporters when they falsely said that the 2020 election was stolen, as they pursue efforts to punish journalists, comedians, and commentators who displease Mr. Trump. Even before the assassination of Mr. Kirk, Mr. Trump was gaining steam in his campaign against traditional media companies. Now it has picked up even more. In a suit Mr. Trump filed against the New York Times this week, the president pointed to the settlements from ABC and CBS as vindication that his suits were highly meritorious. Vice President J.D. Vance said those who celebrated Mr. Kirk's death might be protected on free speech grounds, but they should not be protected from being fired, or in the case of college professors, losing federal funding. Attorney General Pam Bondi told a podcaster, "We will absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech." She amended her comments later to say she would not prosecute speech, but incitements to violence. Mr. Trump wasn't as nuanced on Tuesday when Jonathan Carl, a news correspondent from Mr. Kimmel's network, pressed him on Ms. Bondi's comments and the implications for free speech. "She'll probably go after people like you, because you treat me so unfairly," Mr. Trump said. "You have a lot of hate in your heart. Maybe they will come after ABC. On Thursday, Mr. Trump called Mr. Kimmel a whack job and said he believed regulators should revoke broadcast licenses over late-night hosts who are critical of him. "It will be up to Brendan Carr," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump asks Supreme Court to allow removal of Fed governor. President Trump has pressed to fire Lisa Cook before the central bank's meeting, at which the Fed voted to cut interest rates, by Anne E. Marimo. The Trump administration on Thursday asked the Supreme Court to immediately allow the president to remove Lisa Cook as a Federal Reserve governor, setting up a key test of presidential power with potentially huge economic consequences. President Trump has moved aggressively to fire leaders of independent agencies as he seeks to expand executive power and seize control of the federal bureaucracy. His administration has targeted the central bank for months, pressing policymakers to lower interest rates. The court's conservative majority has repeatedly allowed Mr. Trump to at least provisionally fire leaders of other agencies without stating a reason, despite statutes passed by Congress intended to ensure political independence. The justices, however, have suggested that the Fed may be uniquely insulated from presidential meddling under the law. In any case, with the Fed, Mr. Trump said there was sufficient cause to fire Ms. Cook. Justice Department lawyers have argued that the president has the power to fire Ms. Cook because Mr. Trump has alleged that she engaged in mortgage fraud in loan documents she signed before she joined the Fed in 2022. Ms. Cook has not been charged with a crime. The emergency request to the Supreme Court came 3 days after an appeals court refused to allow the president to remove Ms. Cook, who was appointed by President Joseph R. Biden Jr., while her lawsuit challenging her firing was pending. As a result, Ms. Cook was present on Wednesday when the Federal Reserve voted to cut interest rates for the first time since December. Solicitor General D. John Sauer told the justices on Thursday that the reinstatement of Ms. Cook by the lower courts was yet another case of improper judicial interference with the president's removal authority. Here, interference with the president's authority to remove members of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors for cause. In response, Ms. Cook's lawyers urged the justices to resist the president's request, which they said would be an extraordinary step. Temporarily removing her from her post would threaten our nation's economic stability and raise questions about the Federal Reserve's continued independence, risking shockwaves in the financial markets that could not easily be undone, her legal team said in a new filing. A U.S. District Court judge in Washington on September 9th had temporarily blocked Mr. Trump from ousting Ms. Cook. The judge, Jaya Cobb, said Ms. Cook could not be removed for conduct that occurred before she became a Fed governor, nor for claims that did not involve her professional conduct. The government then filed an emergency request with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. A divided 3-judge panel refused to immediately allow Ms. Cook's removal, prompting the appeal to the Supreme Court. In a 2-1 decision, the appeals court said tenure protections for the Fed were devised to assure members of the Board of Governors and national and global markets that they do not serve at will, and thus enjoy a measure of policy independence from the president, according to a statement written by Judge Bradley N. Garcia and joined by Judge J. Michelle Childs, both nominees of Mr. Biden. Judge Gregory G. Katsas dissented, citing the Federal Reserve Act, first enacted in 1913, which states that each member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors will hold office for 14 years unless removed for cause by the president. The president plainly invoked a cause relating to Cook's conduct, ability, fitness, or competence, wrote Judge Katsas, who was nominated by Mr. Trump. The allegations against Cook could constitute mortgage fraud if she acted knowingly, and that is a felony offense. The administration's filing on Thursday asked Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. to immediately clear the way for Ms. Cook's removal while litigation continued at the D.C. Circuit. Mr. Trump's lawyers said the lower court rulings invite judicial micromanagement of his executive powers, even where, as here, courts have no authority to review the substance of the president's ultimate decision. The government's lawyers also pushed back on the appeals court's finding that Ms. Cook had not had a fair or due process to respond to the allegations against her. Due process is a flexible concept. Whatever process is due to principal officers was provided here, Mr. Sauer wrote. Ms. Cook's lawyers had warned in court filings that a decision preventing her from attending this week's meeting and casting a vote on interest rates would have roiled the financial markets and undermined the independence of the Fed. The Supreme Court has recently signaled in other cases that the Fed is distinct from other independent agencies and may deserve special consideration, in part because of its central role in the American economy. In a pair of cases decided on its emergency docket in May, the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to fire leaders of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board without stating a reason. But the court's order distinguished the Fed, saying it was a uniquely structured, quasi-private entity that follows in the distinct historical tradition of the first and second banks of the United States. The government's lawyers acknowledged in their filing on Thursday that the Fed plays a uniquely important role in the American economy, but they told the justices that the Fed's importance only heightens the government's and the public's interest in ensuring that an ethically compromised member does not continue wielding its vast powers. Ms. Cook's lawyers, led by Abby Lowell, noted in their filing that Mr. Trump and his administration had waited until after this week's Fed meeting to appeal to the Supreme Court. They wrote that the president may have delayed with the understanding of the chaos that removing Governor Cook before the meeting would create in the financial markets. But then the lawyers wrote, he cannot now establish any need for immediate relief that would disrupt the status quo while this court considers his stay application. Judge blocks administration from immediately removing Guatemalan children. Judge Timothy J. Kelly, a Trump appointee, wrote that the government had given dubious justifications for removing children that crumbled like a house of cards, by Zach Montague. A federal judge on Thursday temporarily prevented the Trump administration from hastily deporting hundreds of Guatemalan children, faulting the government for relying on false pretexts that crumbled like a house of cards when presented in court. In a striking opinion, Judge Timothy J. Kelly, a Trump appointee, wrote that the government had misleadingly presented its actions as a reunification effort, bringing children back to their parents in Guatemala, who it said had requested their return. But he noted that a series of revelations since the children had been roused from their beds in the middle of the night and driven to an airport during the Labor Day weekend cast doubt on the government's representations, suggesting a rushed attempt to remove as many as 327 minors before their lawyers could mount a response. The children came to the United States as unaccompanied minors and have been housed under the supervision of the government in shelters or with families in foster care. There is no evidence before the court that the parents of these children sought their return, he wrote. In a previous directive, Judge Kelly paused the government's ability to deport the children until Thursday. The new order extends that block for the foreseeable future while the lawsuit over their fate continues. He also extended the prohibition to all minors from Guatemala who entered the United States alone and have not exhausted their immigration appeals. As the case has evolved since the holiday weekend, Judge Kelly has challenged a number of the government's claims. During a hearing last week, Judge Kelly grew frustrated after lawyers representing the children presented a report by the Guatemalan Attorney General's office showing that when the Guatemalan government had sought to contact the families of the children, some could not be located, but none of the others had sought their children's return. According to the report, many believed their children were secure in the United States. Some expressed fear for their children's safety if they were forced to return to conditions in Guatemala. In the opinion, Judge Kelly noted that additional questions had emerged this week after a report submitted to Congress by anonymous whistleblowers asserted that the office that monitors the children in the Department of Health and Human Services had ignored its own data showing that at least 30 had signs of having suffered child abuse and neglect in Guatemala. The whistleblower report claimed the Office of Refugee Resettlement had raced to clear the children to be loaded onto planes in what Judge Kelly described as a midnight operation, in spite of the data. Defendants do not claim to have asked the children whether they wanted to go back to Guatemala, whether they were abused or neglected, or whether they want to return to their parents or legal guardians, he wrote. In a statement on Thursday, Tricia McLaughlin, a spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security, said the lawsuit and the ruling were all just to get Trump. This judge is blocking efforts to reunify children with their families, she said. Now these children will have to go to shelters. The Trump administration claimed it had followed a strict procedure for vetting the children before selecting them to be flown back, based on a checklist that included factors such as whether they might face danger. After the government went as far as loading the children onto planes to be flown out over the Labor Day weekend, the judge on holiday duty, Sparkle L. Suknanan, halted the flights and blocked the government from preparing to send more. At the time, President Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, attacked Judge Suknanan and pressed claims made by the Justice Department in court that the Trump administration was returning stranded children who wanted to leave. The Biden judge is effectively kidnapping these migrant children and refusing to let them return to their parents in their home country, he wrote on social media. But Judge Kelly, who has since inherited the case, dismissed the notion that the government was acting responsibly or exercising a narrow authority allowed under the law to repatriate unaccompanied children from abroad. He wrote that the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act allows children to be sent back to their home country only after a strenuous determination that it is in their best interest. He added that the law was designed to prevent child trafficking, and the rushed attempted removal of the children appeared to stretch the law's intended use. While defendants plunged ahead in the middle of the night with their reunification plan and then represented to a judge that a parent or guardian had requested each child's return, that turned out not to be true, he wrote. He said the process outlined in the law was designed to avoid rushed, seemingly error-laden operation to send unaccompanied alien children back to their home countries. Lawyers from the National Immigration Law Center who represented the children had asked Judge Kelly to block the deportation of a larger group of children, roughly 2,000 of whom are living in shelters. They nonetheless celebrated the decision, saying it had prevented an attempt to remove the children without any legal resistance. The court saw through the government's repeated misrepresentations of critical facts to try to justify the indefensible targeting of vulnerable children who would have faced danger if sent to other countries. Efren C. Olivares, a vice president at the National Immigration Law Center, said in a statement. While he limited the ruling on Thursday to Guatemalan children, Judge Kelly, who was appointed to the bench by Mr. Trump in 2017, warned the government not to interpret the opinion as an invitation to expand its operations. Of course, the court does not foreclose expanding the class later if developments warrant that adjustment, he wrote. Defendants should not construe this decision as an invitation to take similar action with respect to these other unaccompanied alien children. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Anti-austerity strikes and protests grip France. Barely a week into the job, Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu faces rising social unrest on top of political deadlock and financial turmoil by Aurelien Breeden and Catherine Porter. Big anti-austerity street marches and labor strikes gripped France on Thursday, raising the pressure faced by Sébastien Lecornu, the country's new prime minister, as he tries to pass a debt-reducing budget by the end of the year. Railway workers, students, civil servants, and others joined protests organized by labor unions to oppose the plans of François Bayrou, Mr. Lecornu's predecessor, to cut 44 billion euros, nearly $54 billion, from next year's state budget. France's Interior Ministry said over 500,000 people had attended the protests. One of the leading labor unions put the figure at over 1 million. Mr. Bayrou was ousted by lawmakers last week, and President Emmanuel Macron replaced him with Mr. Lecornu, a centrist and an ally. But it was not immediately clear whether Mr. Lecornu, who had promised a break with the past, would scrap his predecessor's plans or use them as a basis for lawmakers to amend, and the concern over looming budget cuts has persisted. The budget that was imposed on us by the last prime minister, and the new one will be the same, was one of austerity, said Cecilia Rapine, an archaeologist from Normandy who was hoisting an orange Union flag at the march in Paris as protesters waved smoke bombs and danced to music blaring from trucks. Ms. Rapine said she understood that France's precarious finances needed fixing, but she worried that schools and hospitals would bear the brunt after years of business-friendly tax breaks that she said had deprived the state of funding. Austerity gives no hope, Ms. Rapine said, as orange smoke wafted over her head. It creates more cracks in society. Labor unions say that anything resembling Mr. Bayrou's budget, which, among other measures, proposed to freeze welfare payments at their current level, would place an unacceptable burden on lower and middle class workers. The unions want higher taxes on wealthy individuals and big business, more funding of public services, and a reversal of Mr. Macron's increase in the legal retirement age. Today, we are sending the government a very clear warning. Marie-Lise Léon, leader of the French Democratic Confederation of Labor, the country's largest union, told reporters at the march in Paris, "The budget cannot be built solely on the back of workers." In Paris, many metro lines were running only during rush hour. Traffic was disrupted on regional train lines, but mostly normal on the country's high-speed rail route. Unions estimated that about a third of the elementary school teachers and 45% of middle and high school teachers were striking, though the education ministry cited lower figures. Parts of the Louvre Museum were closed and the Eiffel Tower shut down. The authorities even postponed a move of the Bayeux Tapestry, a medieval embroidery depicting the Norman conquest of England, from a museum in Normandy to a storage area before a loan to Britain next year. The marches were mostly peaceful, but were marred in some cities by clashes between small groups of protesters who threw projectiles or vandalized businesses and riot police officers who responded with volleys of tear gas. The Interior Ministry, which had deployed 80,000 security officers across the country on Thursday, said that the police had apprehended over 300 people in connection with the protests. Nearly 200,000 people gathered around France last week for similar protests, initiated by a nebulous, uncoordinated online movement called Bloquons Tout, or Let's Block Everything. While those demonstrations did not bring the country to a standstill, they attracted about twice as many people as the authorities had expected, signaling deep-seated discontent. Mr. Lecornu quickly dropped one of his predecessor's most unpopular ideas, scrapping two national holidays. He also announced that the government would curb certain perks for former cabinet members, like receiving police protection or getting a personal secretary and a driver. The move was mostly symbolic, as it is expected to save only a drop in the bucket compared with France's deficit, which has ballooned to 166.6 billion euros, the largest since World War II. We cannot ask the French people to make efforts if those at the head of the state do not do so themselves, Mr. Lecornu said last week in an interview with French newspapers. But Mr. Lecornu's first moves have not placated the social unrest so far. Matthew Berthier, a prison worker marching in Paris with members of his union, said more was needed. If the government is stubborn, he warned, it will be thrown out too. To avoid the fate of his last two predecessors, both of whom were toppled by lawmakers, Mr. Lecornu has been consulting with political parties and labor representatives over the past week to hammer out his 2026 budget. In a statement after the protests, Mr. Lecornu said that he was committed to continuing dialogue with all social partners, and that the protesters' demands were at the heart of the consultations. But the lower house of parliament is divided into three blocks, left, center, and far right, that disagree on how to address France's finances, giving him a very narrow path to success. To break the political deadlock, the nationalist anti-immigrant National Rally Party is pushing Mr. Macron to call parliamentary elections. The far-left France Unbowed Party wants him to step down. But the president has rejected both demands and has asked instead that Mr. Lecornu find a budget deal. That has put the more moderate Socialist Party in a key position. It has 66 lawmakers in the 577-seat lower house, enough to make or break a no-confidence vote. But its demands, such as a 2% tax on wealth above 100 million euros, run counter to Mr. Macron's pro-business agenda. After a meeting on Wednesday, Olivier Faure, leader of the Socialist Party, said that Mr. Lecornu had been evasive about his budget plans. "So far, we are left hungry for more," he said. Fitch Ratings downgraded France's sovereign debt rating last week, citing the increased fragmentation and polarization of the country's politics. The deficit is well above the 3% limit required in the eurozone. The national debt hit 3.35 trillion euros this year, or 116% of economic output, one of the heaviest burdens in the eurozone. The instability has had more than just financial consequences. Sophie Gall, a middle school English teacher from a town near Montpellier, noted at the march in Paris that a series of cabinet shuffles and collapses over the past 2 years has produced a dizzying succession of education ministers. "Every time, we need to restart," she said. "Problems are never addressed." Leaders of Canada and Mexico talk trade and security without U.S. Looming over the discussions was the desire to preserve the country's free trade agreement with the United States, by Ian Austin and Emiliano Rodriguez Mega. The leaders of Canada and Mexico, the United States' two largest trading partners, met in Mexico City on Thursday without their U.S. counterpart, but the trade chaos brought by President Trump still filled the room. Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada and President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico focused the meeting at the National Palace on trade, security cooperation, and investments in areas like mining, agriculture, and natural gas. But looming over everything was the desire of the two leaders to preserve their free trade partnership with the United States, which has so far limited the effect of President Trump's tariffs on their economies. This week, Mexico and the United States opened public consultations on the trade pact, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, or USMCA, the first step in a review of the agreement. Canada is expected to follow shortly. At the end of their talks on Thursday, the two leaders released a plan to cooperate in a variety of areas, particularly the development of ports, railways, and energy corridors, apparently intended to bolster trade between the two countries that bypass the United States. The document, while short on firm commitments and specifics, includes efforts to deal with drug and human trafficking and environmental measures. Mr. Carney's visit appeared to have reestablished trust between the countries, trust that has been shaky at times since the renegotiation of the previous deal, the North American Free Trade Agreement, during the first Trump administration. Mexico and Canada will continue to walk together with mutual respect and with the certainty that cooperation is the way to overcome any challenge of our time, Ms. Sheinbaum said at a news conference after the meetings. Both leaders deflected questions about the possibility of acting as a united front against the United States, and even the fear that the Trump administration might try to pit them against each other. I am an optimist, Ms. Sheinbaum said. The best way to compete with other regions of the world is to strengthen the trade agreement between the three countries. The Trump administration has imposed steep tariffs on some exports from Canada, which has been one of the few countries, along with China, to retaliate against U.S. trade measures. Canada and Mexico have failed to strike a U.S. trade deal like Britain, the European Union, and Japan. But Mexico has been given a series of extensions on trade talks, dodging the worst of tariffs and benefiting from the terms of the USMCA, which was negotiated during Trump's first term. Though they are bound together in a trade deal with the United States, the two countries' own economic and cultural relations have always been distant. Mexico accounted for 1% of Canadian exports last year, and Canada represents around 3% of Mexico's export market. Separated by the United States, both countries long prioritized trade with their giant neighbor rather than building ties with each other across, over, or around it. Bilateral meetings between them have been rare. Some Canadians view Mexico with distrust. That's particularly the case in Ontario, which has seen much of its automotive industry dwindle as car makers have expanded in Mexico and the southern United States. Mr. Carney arrived at a low point in relations. The previous government, led by Justin Trudeau, angered Mexico by reintroducing visas for visitors from Mexico in early 2024. The measure meant to limit asylum claims in Canada and address American complaints that Mexicans were using Canada as a way to enter the United States. After Mr. Trump's election in November, some Canadian politicians suggested that their country ditch Mexico from the three-nation trade deal, although that sentiment has since largely faded. So far, the North American trade deal has put Mexico and Canada in a relatively advantageous position, because nearly all exports traded under the USMCA are free of the U.S. tariffs imposed on Mexican and Canadian goods. Separate global tariffs apply to auto, steel, and aluminum. But an unpredictable and aggressive neighbor has convinced both Canada and Mexico to reduce their reliance on the United States. When the U.S. treats its partners like adversaries, its partners start acting like allies, said Daniel Treffler, a trade economist at the University of Toronto who has advised the Canadian government on past trade negotiations. Industries in both countries have wish lists of products they hope to export. Mexico is looking to expand food exports to Canada, which now relies heavily on the United States, for fresh produce during the winter. It is also seeking more investment from Canadian companies. Canada wants to expand its farm exports to Mexico and hopes that Mexico will substitute Canadian natural gas for current imports from the United States. Investments and trade in different areas will increase. How much could they increase? Well, that's part of what we're going to be working on in the coming months, Ms. Sheinbaum said. Sebastian Vallejo Vera, a political scientist at Western University in London, Ontario, said Ms. Sheinbaum may have also given Mr. Carney tips on how to navigate an antagonistic U.S. administration. The relationship between Mexico and America has been more fraught and for longer than the relationship between Canada and America, he said. Even if Mexico and Canada manage to agree on an approach to maintain the USMCA deal, they hope to avoid the perception that the two countries are ganging up on the United States. There's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to Trump and his trade policy in general, Professor Vallejo-Vera said. I don't think anybody's very certain on what his next move is going to be. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. to cut out non-governmental groups in refocusing health aid. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the United States would negotiate agreements to deliver aid in new ways and would focus on the Western Hemisphere and Asia Pacific. By Edward Wong. The Trump administration is changing how and where the U.S. government delivers health aid around the world, breaking decades of practice to bypass non-governmental organizations and prioritize the Western Hemisphere and Asia-Pacific regions over Africa, U.S. officials said Thursday. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's new approach aims to end a culture of dependency among recipient countries, he said in a document announcing the change. In the coming months, the State Department plans to negotiate new bilateral agreements with countries to deliver health aid in ways that cut out non-governmental organizations. For decades, U.S. officials assessed that those groups had more technical expertise than partner governments, so they helped manage and deliver health aid in many nations. The new strategy also veers away from decades of focus on Africa, where many nations rely on the U.S. government to help with HIV prevention and treatment. It follows Mr. Rubio's dismantlement this year of the United States Agency for International Development, which was created by the Kennedy administration in 1961 and put under congressional mandate to deliver health aid and other forms of assistance around the globe. That agency and the State Department, as well as other parts of the U.S. federal government, had worked for decades with both partner governments and non-governmental organizations in the United States and other countries to deliver aid. Many health experts say the dismantled USAID and drastic cuts to foreign assistance that began after President Trump took office in January have endangered lives and health of millions of people overseas, particularly in Africa and Asia. The new approach by Mr. Rubio is laid out in a document the State Department released on Thursday called America First Global Health Strategy. On the opening page, Mr. Rubio argued for changes to the traditional way of dispensing foreign assistance. Our health foreign assistance programs in particular have become inefficient and wasteful, too often creating parallel healthcare delivery systems and a culture of dependency among recipient countries, he wrote. Many of the NGOs who support these programs have committed many times to helping transition the work to local governments, but little progress has been made. The executive summary says that many non-governmental groups that receive funding approved by Congress, especially for technical assistance and program management, have perverse incentives to self-perpetuate rather than work towards turning functions over to local governments. The document says the State Department will work to complete negotiations with nations on new ways of delivering health aid by the end of this year and begin putting them in place by April. A Trump administration official briefing mostly State Department reporters on Thursday said that the document provided a framework and that State Department officials would start negotiations with counterparts from various countries on the sidelines of the annual United Nations General Assembly in New York next week. The official said the State Department, which took over the remnants of USAID's foreign assistance programs, would continue to provide HIV prevention and treatment aid to African nations. But, he said, there were many non-HIV diseases and health areas on which the U.S. planned to focus through direct partnerships with other governments, including tuberculosis in the Asia-Pacific region and maternal and child health. The official was one of three on call with reporters. All three insisted on speaking on the condition of anonymity, which is typical of such background briefings in Washington. Many global health experts and African officials have criticized the Trump administration's crippling of PEPFAR, a program started by President George W. Bush to curtail HIV, and which has saved millions of lives, primarily in African nations. The program has won praise from Republican and Democratic officials over the decades. State Department officials have drawn up plans to end the program in the coming years, the New York Times reported in July. A State Department spokeswoman said at the time that the planning document had not been finalized. The Trump administration official said the new health aid framework is not aimed at making immediate budget cuts. The document released Thursday says that as partner governments take over more duties in the delivery and management of health care, the U.S. government will be cutting assistance. The Fed has no good options as hiring wobbles and inflation picks up. The central bank is grappling with how quickly to lower interest rates after restarting cuts on Wednesday amid mixed economic signals and a relentless White House pressure campaign. By Colby Smith. For the Federal Reserve, there are no good options. Its chair, Jerome H. Powell, made that clear on Wednesday, shortly after the central bank cut interest rates for the first time this year. There are no risk-free paths now, said Mr. Powell. It's not incredibly obvious what to do. The comment was in reference to the tough bind that the Fed now finds itself in at a time when inflation is moving further away from the central bank's 2% target, and the labor market is looking much more wobbly. The Fed cannot address both issues simultaneously, and trying to resolve one typically jeopardizes the other. Our tools can't do two things at once, added Mr. Powell. The Fed's cut on Wednesday brought interest rates down to a new range of 4% to 4.25%. What the Fed is now trying to figure out is how quickly it should bring interest rates to a neutral level that neither speeds up growth nor slows it down. If it moves too slowly, it risks causing undue economic damage. If it moves too quickly, it risks stoking inflation. An already tenuous situation is being further complicated by President Trump's attempts to undermine the Fed's political independence in order to push borrowing costs much higher. The scale of Mr. Powell's problem could be seen in the closely watched dot plot released on Wednesday, a chart that shows where each of the Fed's 19 policymakers expect interest rates to be over the next several years. The latest version indicated that most officials expect another half percentage point reduction in borrowing costs this year, which would bring interest rates to a range of 3.5 to 3.75%. Yet way down at the bottom of the chart stood a lone dot. That reflected one policymaker's view that interest rates should end the year between 2.75 and 3%, substantially lower than current levels. The forecasts are anonymous, but all signs point to that dot belonging to Steven Mnuchin, the Fed governor who Mr. Trump tapped in August and was sworn in as a member of the Fed's Board of Governors just before the central bank's two-day meeting began on Tuesday. Mr. Mnuchin, who still has ties to the president because he has decided not to resign from his role as chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, was raced through the Senate confirmation process at the behest of the White House, which wanted him in place in time to vote on interest rates on Wednesday. If it was indeed Mr. Mnuchin, the dot plot suggests that he supports two more big cuts at each of this year's remaining meetings. The fact that Mr. Powell did not have to contend with more formal dissents was a feat, given that at the previous meeting in July, the decision to hold interest rates steady was opposed by two other members of the board. In the lead-up to September's meeting, some policymakers had even questioned whether it was the right time to lower borrowing costs when inflation was accelerating once again. But forging any kind of consensus is bound to remain difficult so long as the Fed's goals of low, stable inflation and a healthy labor market stay in tension with one another. Officials actually appeared fairly divided over where to take interest rates this year. Mr. Powell framed the decision to lower interest rates as a risk management move to protect the labor market from weakening. In doing so, he signaled that the Fed was now prioritizing that goal over containing inflation. Jonathan Pingle, who used to work at the Fed and is now chief U.S. economist at UBS, said that pivot made sense at a time when the labor market was really losing momentum and the primary source of price pressures, Mr. Trump's tariffs, was not something the central bank could do much about. The severity of the inflation threat also matters. Mr. Powell on Wednesday said that the prospect of a persistent inflation outbreak has lessened, given that tariffs had raised consumer prices by a lesser magnitude and more gradually than first feared. But the Fed's decision to focus on the labor market represents somewhat of a gamble when it is not entirely clear whether the slowdown in monthly jobs growth is a function of falling demand or a reduced supply of workers as a result of Mr. Trump's immigration crackdown. Indeed, Mr. Powell noted on Wednesday that policymakers had, in the aggregate, revised higher their forecasts for growth for this year and next, while maintaining that the unemployment rate would rise only marginally to 4.5% and then decline. As of August, it stood at 4.3%. Michael Gapin, chief U.S. economist at Morgan Stanley, said the Fed should be wary about lowering interest rates too much against this backdrop. The cost to them could be a much more prolonged overshoot of inflation that calls into question their inflation credibility, he said. Jane Austen's birthday party is BYOB, bring your own bonnet. The Grand Regency costumed promenade in Bath, England is the showiest and merriest of the celebrations of the writer's 250th, by Sarah Lyle. Of all the activities at the annual Jane Austen Festival in Bath, England, the walking tours, the lectures, the teas, the balls, the dramatic performances, and games of croquet, the showiest and merriest is the Grand Regency Costumed Promenade, a public display of sartorial ingenuity and Austen ardor that winds through the heart of the town. Last Saturday's parade, in the year that Janeites are celebrating the 250th anniversary of the writer's birth, was particularly exciting. The clothes, A-line dresses, Spencer jackets, bonnets, and small drawstring handbags, known as reticules, for ladies, breeches, waistcoats, jackets, cravats, and top hats for gentlemen. Gathering genteelly along the Grand Royal Crescent, some 2,000 costumed personages processed in a stately manner through the city until they reached the parade gardens, which provided a felicitous backdrop for further admiration of the outfits. Women greatly outnumbered men, and anyone hoping to engineer a meet-cute with their own Mr. Darcy was most likely disappointed. But there was a large contingent of lively military reenactors from His Majesty's 33rd Regiment of Foot for those who, like Lydia Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, love a man in a uniform. Austen herself lived in Bath for a scant 5 years and didn't much care for the place. But long stretches of Northanger Abbey and Persuasion are set in the city, whose grand Georgian architecture makes it look, except for inconvenient anachronisms like cars, cell phones, and the odd Burger King, just as it did in the 19th century, especially when it's full of visitors who have dressed the part. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, September 19th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.